What do these three things have in common? Coney Island, a hard-boiled egg, and multicolored frogs.
It's not that easy being green.
Today in Studio 360, scientists and artists who are making green a little easier.
We go back to the hotel room and figure out how much green energy credits we have to do instead of figuring out how many lines we're going to snort or something like that.
We'll hear from an environmental rock band and from an architect building the house of the future, inspired by an egg.
An egg is nothing, see? But that eggshell, see, the strength of it will never fail.
Creative minds going green. That's ahead in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Even with the intense recent focus on healthcare reform and the economic crisis, climate change and the environment are a gigantic issue that isn't going away.
Global warming is a hot topic.
A vast majority of Americans, 85%, now believe global warming is
real,
probably
and
happening.
It's almost certainly caused by what we humans do to this planet.
How much is the concern over climate change a panicky left-wing myth? How much really is established science?
Stolen emails from top researchers were posted online. Global warming skeptics saying those emails suggest that scientists may have worked together to manipulate global warming data.
Well, in any case, the fact remains that going green, sustainability, is one of the defining issues of the early 21st century.
For while the reality of climate change is not in doubt, I have to be honest, as the world watches us today, I think our ability to take collective action is in doubt right now.
Today in Studio 360, we're taking a look at some creative approaches to our environmental challenges. We'll hear from scientists and engineers and artists with cutting-edge solutions that just might change their corners of the world entirely. And some that are a little out there.
And I open it up, so the two crates open, and the guts of the electric circuit is right there.
This is Muna Andreas. She's showing us her invention, the power cart. It's a portable street generator that runs on renewable energy.
I need to find a hammer.
The thing fits in a couple of wine crates clamped to a hand truck. There are gears made out of wood, the size of dinner plates. The front of the cart has a 12-volt solar panel. We sent Ada Lee Halofsky along to try it out.
Muna Andreas is in the middle of repairing the power cart. Muna manages with a pair of pliers.
Every time you think something's going to be easy and will be done in 10 minutes, something else happens or breaks or doesn't work or doesn't fit.
The power cart basically works like this. A hand crank rotates a set of gears, which turn the shaft of a motor. That generates energy, which gets stored in a battery. The solar cell also charges the battery. The cart is wired to about 20 connectors for cell phones, laptops, even household AC outlets. But here's the thing. Muna is not at all qualified to build something like the power cart. Muna was a web designer who got tired of clicking and dragging.
Every time I connect a cell phone, my heart stops for about a second or two until that charge happens. And before I plug them in, I look at them and I say, you know, the American thing, la la la, you resign all your rights and liabilities in case something happens. And they laugh and I plug it in. I say, I said it, you know.
First, are you an engineer, an artist, a scientist, or, I mean, there's a lot of engineering in here.
George Sidebotham is a professor of mechanical engineering at the Cooper Union in New York. I brought him in to check out the power cart.
So I don't know if you're trained or if you have someone helping you out or if you're a tinkerer.
Not an engineer at all. in the context of this project, picked it up on the fly, mostly online. So
okay, so all of the like the electrical wiring and all the components and things, you just went online and sort of taught yourself, and you made all the did all the connections yourself. And
pretty soon, they were collaborators.
You know, maybe a small windmill or something, and you can take a basketball and cut it in half and tie it together and put it in a wind.
There are other devices that let people self-charge their gadgets, things you can do at your desk or watching TV. But she thinks there's something special about a pushcart.
I've always been fascinated by street vendors ever since I was young, either traveling or in Lebanon, where I'm from originally. They're really mobile and going from people's places to other people's places. And every time they arrive, they'll make a specific sound. They'll scream in Arabic, you know, kak, kak, the bread, the bread. And so if you're sitting in your house and you hear him from far, you know they're coming.
Muna pushes the 60-pound load at a pretty fast clip.
It's actually really not that bad. You have to find the right angle.
Most of the traffic we hit is on the sidewalk from rubbernecking. You are a spectacle pushing this thing.
It's a power generator.
Oh. Does it work for you?
Or yeah, it works.
Really?
Yeah.
And this is your invention?
Yeah.
Kinetic electricity.
Exactly.
Right.
Wow.
I don't remember my science. Thank you for reminding me.
Very cool.
Not that part.
Awesome. This is exactly what the world needs.
What?
It's perfect.
Why?
Because, like, electricity should be free because it's the universe. Like, it's our world, you know?
It still costs a lot of money and work and time, but today it's free.
That guy lost his phone charger 3 weeks before and was thrilled to get a boost. He left his phone for an hour to run some errands and came back, happier than ever with the universe.
We could make tons of these and bring them all over the city. We got to expand it beyond cell phones. There's got to be a way to, like, power other things. Like, how are we going to find that need, you know? Like.
But most people aren't willing to walk away from a cell phone, much less a laptop. And about 3 hours out, we had only 3 customers, including me.
Like so many things in the renewable energy, is it going to change the world by itself? No, of course not. And so much of it, really, of our future is mindset. People are going to have to be willing to say, I have to change my lifestyle.
You get out of your lab and you go in the streets and you meet real people. It's always invigorating. It reminds you why you've been doing all that. So I think the power cart story is not over. It's going to have a little life.
Baby, you're improvable.
For Studio 360, I'm Ada Lee Halofsky.
Take long, mountains can be movable.
And you can see some pictures of the power cart at studio360.org. But even if we had power carts on every corner, we wouldn't be able to run our cars on them. So for a more large-scale, state-of-the-art solution to our energy needs, I wanted to talk with Frances Arnold. She's a biochemical engineer at Caltech in Pasadena, California. Her work is to tinker with the genetic codes of bacteria, bacteria that can then turn grasses and other simple plants into fuel for cars and trucks.
Just like breeding, just like you breed cats and dogs, we can breed now at the molecular level. So you don't have to understand exactly what DNA encodes a beautiful cat, but you know a beautiful cat when you see it. And so you can breed for those properties in molecules just like you can with cats, racehorses, corn, you name it.
But breeding, and certainly evolution, is a slow process. How are you able to speed it up in your lab?
Well, from an engineering point of view, maybe we have weeks, or if you're lucky, a few months to achieve new properties that might take millions of years in nature. But more importantly, I get to decide who lives and who dies. And so I do selective breeding, and I can, without compunction, throw out millions of molecules that I don't like and keep the ones that I do like. And I've measured some property that they have, their ability to convert lead into gold or something that might be useful. And if I like them, I keep them, and I breed them on to the next generation. The challenge is that biological things have one thing in mind, so to speak, and that's making more of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The genes want to make more genes. My job is to get those genes to make something useful for humans, to subvert these little organisms and convince them that they would like to convert glucose, or even better, cellulose, into a fuel that you can put into your gas tank.
And what do these organisms look like?
Well, in the big scale, they look like brown mush. But if you look at them under the microscope, they're little motile critters that float around in your petri dish looking for something useful to do.
Does it feel like designing to you in the way that most of us understand what design means?
Well, it's not like you're writing down the whole blueprint for a house. So it's not design like that. But most of the things, when you really think about it, that humans do, we do things by trial and error. You try a few things, they don't work, you tweak it, you try it again. And very few people can write down a perfect design from the beginning.
So we're growing more and more corn to make ethanol, and we see all this media coverage and ads for cars that run on ethanol, but you're already moving beyond that. Why are our cellulose plants the better raw ingredient?
Well, that's really the key goal. Corn is not going to solve our energy problems. There's not enough of it to make enough ethanol to have an impact on our fuel usages. So we have to move to energy crops that are almost all cellulosic.
Once you've solved this butanol biofuels problem to your satisfaction, do you have a sense of then starting in 2013, I'll be doing this? Do you know what's next?
Oh, I don't know what's next. And that's really the glory of this job. I'm very good at engineering new biological things. That's what I know how to do. What I think is that interesting problems will continue to come up. And if I can contribute to finding a solution to those problems, I'll be thrilled. But I can't anticipate right now what the problems of 2013 are going to be. However, I will guess, I'll hazard a guess, that energy will continue to be a major problem in 2013, and probably even more important than it is today.
It's not that easy being green.
Francis Arnold is professor of biochemical engineering at Caltech and the founder of the research company Gevo. You can find out more about her and biofuels at studio360.org.
Because you're not standing out like flashy sparkles in the water or stars in the sky.
Coming up, a new kind of house takes root in Southern California. It might remind you of something from a movie.
Tell Uncle, if he gets a translator, be sure it speaks Bocce.
A movie set on the planet Tatooine. The futuristic houses of Cal Earth. That's ahead in Studio 360.
From PRI and WNYC.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by Kohler, dedicated to helping people save water without sacrificing performance or great design. For more information on how you can save water and support Habitat for Humanity, visit SaveWaterAmerica.com.
I'm Kurt Anderson. In this special edition of Studio 360, we're looking at how design is trying to let us live environmentally smarter. A couple of years ago, a liberal slogan warned that the biggest weapons of mass destruction were sitting in our driveway. Well, it's not just the SUV. The modern house itself eats up a lot of energy and non-renewable resources. So what might the ultra-efficient home of the future look like? Studio 360's Eric Malinsky went to Los Angeles, got in the car with some friends, and tried to find an answer.
Rudy Burden and Nora Murphy live a pretty sweet life. They're artists who work on cartoon shows like The Simpsons. They live in a charming neighborhood of bungalows just off Hollywood Boulevard. But they secretly dream of living in a giant igloo made of dirt.
And here's Keller, you can see on your right.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's... Totally different.
We drove an hour east of LA to the town of Hesperia. As I entered Cal Earth, I felt like I was walking onto the set of Luke Skywalker's house.
It's like Star Wars and Lord of the Rings put together.
The connection to outer space is not a coincidence. The idea for these homes came from a lunar colony. It started out as a NASA project designed by the Iranian architect Nadir Khalili, who passed away in March of 2008. When I spoke with him in the fall of 2007, he told me he believed his designs would catch on here on Earth if only people would start asking the right questions.
After the disasters, the question is wrong when we ask, when is FEMA coming? What type of insurance do you have? What is the problem? In the rest of the world, they ask always, when is UN coming? The right question is, why are buildings burn? Why are they falling apart in a hurricane? Why are they this? That is the question that will be the basis of a great solution.
The ecodomes, also known as super adobes, don't use any wood. There are no right angles. And they're very affordable. The shell of an 800-square-foot house costs $10,000.
They're just using the earth under our feet. Almost anywhere in the world you can use this earth. And then we put it in these long sandbags. We call it tube, super adobe tubes. And then we lay them, we put them in the layers after we put some earth in it, pack in there, and then add maybe 10% cement, concrete in it. And then on top of that, after we tamp it, we put a layer of barbed wire, four-point barbed wire. Just it will work with the next layer, just like a Velcro. Just stick every layer to the next layer.
I took a walk through the domes with my friends, Rudy and Nora. The early ones are very simple. They're almost like mosques. Eventually, we made our way to a super adobe ranch house. It's meant to be in the same league as the suburban homes that surround Keller.
Yeah, and you know, they didn't have to put in any hallways or anything. They just stacked the arches like a pyramid. And so you just weave in and out of the rooms, which is really nice.
We're underground right now. I mean,
yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Calearth is probably the only place in Hesperia that doesn't need air conditioning. The cool air from the night gets trapped in the domes.
But it also gives you this amazing view.
This is gonna be the strangest view out of a kitchen window I've ever seen.
Yeah. And then there's this beautiful little earth dome house right across the street. The neighbors got it too.
Showing up at Calearth is almost like showing up at a casting call for Southern California characters. There's an Indian chief, Charles Wood, of the Chemehuevian tribe.
For me, to build a house, that cement truck has to come 80 miles. And here I see a possible answer for my people.
Jim Guerra represents Mexican migrant farm workers.
They work in flowers and strawberries. And like most farm workers today, they live on the ground. There's no housing, no toilets, no showers.
Savannah Sierra Glazer came here from Santa Monica with her fiancé. They're shopping for houses.
I'm not sure what that dome over there is called, the big, big, big one. Mm-hmm. We'd like that to be the center and have like six of the little ecodomes around it, connected to it. So something like that where it would develop community for the people that we invite over. Because we'd like to entertain a lot of people.
River Oliveira just has a thing for domes.
Well, yeah, that's what domes do. They give that kind of energy. The electromagnetic field, it functions in that method. Huh. So when you're in it, you're part of it.
That's very beautiful.
Thanks. Life's beautiful.
Yeah.
Breathing's beautiful.
But the super adobes are more than funky. They're sturdy. Phil Vittori is a structural engineer.
Now, I started when I was 24 years old, and I'm 70 now, so that's a lot of years in the dome business.
He collaborated with Khalili for 10 years, and they shared an appreciation for the simple physics of a curve.
If you take a stick and put it between two points and you put a weight in the center, you'll see the stick deflects downward. If you take that same stick and you curve it into an arch, when you put weight on it, it does not bend downward. Now, if you take an arch and you rotate the arch through 360 degrees, you end up with a dome.
Children who come here and we tell them to bring a boiled egg, and we tell them to try to break it by putting it between the palm of their hands. And of course, the more they push, the more double, triple of them press, I can't. And they're, of course, very, very surprised always, because an egg is nothing, you see? But that eggshell, you see, the strength of it is what is called double curvature, and it will never fail.
Phil Vittori was at Cal Earth when the city of Hesperia tested the domes with an earthquake simulator. The homes didn't budge or crack. In fact, the earthquake simulator began to bend and buckle.
We had to call the test at that point. We were well past any design load characteristics. We were over double the amount that would be required by code.
Kalili got the seal of approval from the UN and FEMA, but the designs are pretty radical, so agencies have been slow to adopt them wholesale. Kalili realized that if he wanted to spark a worldwide movement, he needed to make them popular in America.
This is so great. Oh my goodness.
Maureen lives in San Bernardino, the first county in the nation to officially approve the Super Adobe homes. She's planning to put one up.
You should be able to just go to your local zoning board and say, look at this, the R insulation factor is better than anything else, can build itself, it's very easy on the eye, you know, everyone should be living like this.
But local building and planning departments have been the biggest hurdle. Their codes only cover traditional housing.
I had to bring in the text of analyzing a dome for the building department and then run the numbers for them and then teach them how to read the text. Otherwise, they had no idea how to evaluate the design.
A lot of people told me they were frustrated with the pace of progress, but Kalili was always patient. He knew he had inspired a movement. And now that he's gone, his friends and students are ready to take over the CalEarth Institute. And visitors to CalEarth will keep dreaming of living in a house that beats an earthquake, stays cool without air conditioning, doesn't harm a single tree, and costs less than a used car.
As my son was suggesting, he says one of the ways that we can get it into American market is to do some sitcoms in these structures. And he may be right, you know. You know, the sitcom, everybody feels comfortable and funny and experience all of these, and then they'll want it.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Malinsky.
At our website, you can see the CalEarth Dome House inside and out. That's studio360.org. But it's not just in the California deserts where you can see nifty green architecture. The New York City subway system has one of the best environmental designs done recently, according to the American Institute of Architects. So I hopped on my neighborhood line, the F train, and rode all the way down to the end.
We actually see the roller coaster and the Ferris wheel, and here we are at Astroland Amusement Park, the traditional reason to come to Coney Island.
Coney Island's Stillwell Avenue station sits a block away from the Atlantic Ocean. Four different mass transit lines terminate here, and millions of people stream through every year.
Here we are at Stillwell Avenue.
Overhead, covering the whole thing and all the outdoor tracks, is an incredible new train shed with a gorgeous vaulted glass and steel roof.
It's extraordinary. It's 80 feet high, this shed, with steel trusses.
A roof that generates electricity.
Nothing decorative about it, but it's this modern-looking train shed, but in the old-fashioned sort of late 19th century sense of modern, with all the steel trusses and beams exposed, all white and blue and steel-colored.
What could be more green than a mass transit facility run by solar power? That's like green squared. The architect who designed the new building is Greg Kiss. How long have you been working on this?
It's been many years now. It's probably began about 6.5 years ago.
Although, as we'll talk about, I mean, you use this incredibly high-tech solar power generating system. The structure itself, the steel, doesn't look 21st century at all.
I think it's important to evoke the past of a place like this while not aping it. You know, Coney Island has always had an element of sort of retro fantasy in it, but it's also always had a very futuristic side as well. And so we'd like to continue that tradition here.
It is a glass roof, but in each of these glass panes, windows up there, there is a gray structure. Are those the photovoltaic cells?
They are. It's a type of silicon that has three layers to it. One layer is positively charged, the other is negatively charged. They're separated by a neutral layer, and the photons of the light come in and they dislodge electrons from one of these layers. And when they get enough energy, they leap across this neutral barrier in the middle. So we gather that all together, and that DC wire runs down underneath the platforms to an electrical room where there are two inverters. And an inverter is a device that changes the DC electricity to AC. And so it can be used in tandem with the conventional power sources.
So that is saving X tons of greenhouse gases from going into the air from conventionally generated electricity.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The famous place to get a bite around here is Nathan's. Is that close enough to we could go get a hot dog?
Diagonally across the street, the center of the hot dog universe.
Great, let's go.
Oh. Thank you.
Can I get a bacon, cheese, a hot dog, and a regular hot dog? And a bottle of water.
Anything else?
I think that's it.
18 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. In the last year, the Bloomberg administration in New York has developed this comprehensive plan for the next 25 years of sustainable energy use in New York City. You sort of predated that with this project.
This does predate that, and this is to the credit of New York City Transit and their planning process, but really, the needs of our city, our country, the world go way beyond even the mayor's plan. So we will be doing, I'm convinced, much more of this in the near future. You know, you're building a building and you're paying for all this surface and it's sitting in the sun. And in most cases, the sun is not just being wasted, it's being counterproductive. You know, it's heating your building up, so you have to use more energy to air condition it with. And if you can just, instead of fighting against the natural elements in the natural world, if you can just work with it, you end up with something that is really much better and more efficient and more pleasant and a healthier, happier place to be.
Well, and you seem well positioned for the next generation of sustainable architecture.
Well, thanks. I hope so. This is the future. You know, it has to be the future. And as architects, we can either react to it or we can try to lead the process. And the more we do that, the better for everybody, the quicker and better we get to that goal.
Good. Well, thanks for bringing us out to Coney Island.
Well, thank you. And thanks for the hot dog.
She's my Coney Island, baby. She's my Coney Island girl.
You can see some pictures from our trip to the Stillwell Terminal at Coney Island and learn more about photovoltaics at our website, studio360.org. Probably the most famous pioneer of green architecture is William McDonough. When he was just a student back in the 70s, he built a solar house in unsunny Ireland, of all places.
There's probably 5,000 times more solar energy than the humans will ever need. We could cover our highways with solar collectors to make ribbons of energy. And I think that it's really the largest job creation program in the history of the planet that's in front of us. It's a celebration of the abundance of human creativity combined with the abundance of the natural world.
You use the term and have called your book by the term cradle to cradle. Explain that.
Well, cradle to cradle is in counterpoint to cradle to grave. It basically says that if we look at everything as a take, make, and waste system, then it's a one-way system. Whereas if we think about things having multiple lives, cradle to cradle, that we could design things that can go back to either nature or back to industry forever.
And to achieve that obviously requires a rethinking of design at the earliest and deepest levels, not a matter of styling, but how this thing is made and can be remade.
Exactly right.
McDonough thinks big, but he has a pretty humble view of human achievement.
I reflect on the fact that it took us 5,000 years to put wheels on our luggage. So we're not that really smart as a designer, as a design species. But if you look at a tree and think of it as a design assignment, it would be like asking you to make something that makes oxygen, sequesters carbon, fixes nitrogen, distills water, provides habitat for hundreds of species, accrues solar energy as fuel, makes complex sugars in food, changes colors with the seasons, creates microclimates, and self-replicates.
In fact, McDonough has taken so much inspiration from the natural world that he was one of the first big-time architects to design a whole building with a green roof, an actual meadow on top of it, for what was then the headquarters of the Gap.
In the early 90s, we were commissioned by the chairman of the Gap to design their corporate campus in San Bruno, California, and worked with an amazing plant scientist named Paul Gebhardt to collect seeds of the ancient meadows of that place. And so we built the roof to be an oak savanna.
And that's a nice and beautiful idea. What does it do for the building?
It does a lot of things for the building. It thermally insulates the building, keeps it from getting hot and cold when you don't want it to be, and absorbs moisture for stormwater management, which was of immense value because the city of San Bruno's stormwater systems are overloaded.
Do you ever think that beauty in the traditional sense, architecturally, is not compatible with the kind of efficiency that you're talking about?
No, that never occurs to me, because I can't imagine something being beautiful at this point in history if it's destroying the planet or causing children to get sick. How can anything be beautiful if it's not ecologically intelligent at this point?
That's architect William McDonough, who's working on green projects all over the world. Lately, he's been consulting on new housing designs for the Ninth Ward in New Orleans, a project spearheaded by the actor Brad Pitt. You can see photos of McDonough's work at studio360.org. And still to come this hour, an artist who wants to convince the diehards.
I mean, I wish Rush Limbaugh would come to an exhibition so he could see some of the pictures or let me do an environmental survey in his backyard. He might be really fascinated and potentially alarmed at what's going on back there.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by Kohler, dedicated to helping people save water without sacrificing performance or great design. For more information on how you can save water and support Habitat for Humanity, visit SaveWaterAmerica.com.
You remember Live Earth, that giant feel-good rock event from 2007? 150 acts, 11 venues around the world, broadcast globally on television and online.
There is a very, very inconvenient truth that we as a civilization are actually destroying ourselves.
For at least one day, carbon credits and organic cotton t-shirts were de rigueur in pop music. I'm Kurt Anderson, and today in Studio 360, we're talking to scientists and artists and even rock musicians who are trying to save the world, one fan at a time. Sarah Lemanchik has this story.
The most vulnerable part of the Earth's ecological system is the atmosphere. It's so thin.
The problem is this thin layer of atmosphere is being thickened.
I imagine this is what it sounds like when rockers Bon Jovi air An Inconvenient Truth during their concerts, which they do.
There is a message in this.
I'm not making that up. The Green Movement has made some unlikely partnerships. To get a feel for the social pulse of the music industry, I headed to a suburban office park. It's the home of Music Matters, a marketing company that specializes in greening rock operations. President Michael Martin.
We combine activism and marketing and pop culture.
Okay, what do you do?
We help companies and artists to create quantified social change while they grow their business.
In real words, this is what he means.
We have this program set up with a bunch of tours right now where for 15 cent surcharge, a fan can plant a tree when they're buying their ticket, for example. And we've been able to take thousands and thousands of tons out of the air through the use of biodiesel and through the offsets.
Music Matters uses a 6-page rider requiring the venues, the Meadowlands, the Forum, Bird's Tiki Lounge, to green the concert. This process includes the obvious, backstage recycling and carbon credits, to the more intimate.
Not having chemical and pesticide-laden hair care products, cleansing products, dressing room stuff.
Organic soap. It's like the Pollyanna version of the legendary Van Halen rider that prohibited brown M&Ms from being served backstage. But it's not just about making bands nicer. It's about making them popular.
We are creating programs that are allowing the artists to reach more people more effectively, more credibly. It gives radio stations stuff to talk about. It sells more tickets and sells more records.
I'm glad it's popular and I'm glad that it's getting trendy, but it shouldn't get watered down too much. I mean, if you're going to green a tour, it should be more than just buying energy credits for, you know, your travel and whatnot.
Thinking globally and acting locally, I went to my local rock star, Craig Bonoa. He's the singer-songwriter for Cloud Cult, an indie pop darling kind of a band, and a very green one. So green that Craig Bonoa has a basement full of used CD cases. Every Cloud Cult disc that is sold is in a recycled case. And that's just the start.
The inserts that go into that will be 100% post-consumer recycled and printed with the vegetable inks. And then the shrink wrap was a whole another decade-long process because most of the shrink wrap is also PVC.
Cloud Cult uses only a corn-based shrink wrap. You can actually eat it if you need to.
I think initially it kind of hurt us a little bit on a stigma, too, in the sense that when people hear about your environmental pursuits, they immediately assume that you're a certain genre of music, that you're a hippie jam band or you're a really preachy folk singer or something like that.
Because it's hard to imagine David Lee Roth hawking compact fluorescent light bulbs and low-flow toilets.
I think people have equated environmentalism with some sort of just drab, boring, you know, you have to sacrifice all these things, you have to live in a cave, it's just, you know, it's a big downer, you gotta be depressed all the time, and that's the other aspect of environmentalism that is definitely changing with the music industry. And I think that that is the benefit of some of these musicians jumping on board with it. You realize that you can have fun and you can still make smart decisions about what you're doing. His Sunday best includes the helmet of an astronaut,
tablecloth cape, embroidered number 8 sand. But even Manoa admits it can be kind of hard to have fun.
90% of the clubs don't have recycling. You get done with the show and you're looking at this big empty club after everybody left and there's just garbage laying everywhere, and you really scratch your head and wonder what you're doing. We go back to the hotel room and figure out how much green energy credits we have to do instead of figuring out how many lines we're going to snort or something like that. It's pretty boring.
But really, we should all be so willing as to do what we think is right, even if there's less cocaine and people take pot shots at you. Rock on, green rockers. Rock on. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Lemanchek.
If I were Cloud Cult, I think I'd be working on a new anthem for the environmental movement. An anthem would be really useful because right now the closest thing we've got dates from 1970.
Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone.
Except it's pretty hard to top Joni Mitchell. Mitchell said that she wrote that song in a hotel in Hawaii. She looked down from her balcony at the stretch of asphalt below, and that phrase, "they paved paradise and put up a parking lot," sprang to mind. She says the chords came just as naturally.
Big Yellow Taxi is a nursery rhyme, but it's basically Chuck Berry. But with my voice, and, you know, sometimes you wouldn't recognize necessarily the influences because they're not imitative per se, you know. But rock and roll was just boogie woogie played on guitar. It's like a Chuck Berry song. In form and rhythm and everything, it's basically that genre. Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline. Or, you know, way back about the woods, da 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 da. It's like, they paved paradise, put up a parking lot. I mean, it's the same stuff. It's, you know, it's its own melody, but it's the same genre.
We use Joni Mitchell's phrase about paving paradise all the time when we talk about woods or farms or small towns giving way to sprawl. At this point, it's an idiom. And as for Joni, she still gets annoyed with what she finds in hotels.
Like, I'm staying in a hotel. It says it's green. It's got this card by the bed. If you know, we're green. If we're conserving water. If you want your sheets changed, put this on the bed. But they've got all these electrical buttons to pull the curtains. You know, give me back a pull cord. You know, if you're green, give me a pull cord. Why do you need juice for that?
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Artists who want to weigh in on environmental issues sometimes have to get their hands dirty, literally. For instance, a photographer named Brandon Ballinger begins his work day by wading into a swamp.
It's pretty hard work. It's not so glamorous. You're kind of out in the field for 14 hours a day sometimes, and you've got these heavy waders on, and it's really hot, and you're getting eaten alive by mosquitoes and other great parasites that are burrowing in under your fingernails and things like that.
And what's he doing out there? Ballinger is an eco-artist, using the fine arts in the service of communicating science. He told Studio 360's Trey Kay why he spends his days hunting for frogs.
Well, I think sculpturally they're fascinating. I mean, they have a real kind of uncanny presence about them.
We're not talking about frogs that you kiss and then poof, they turn into a handsome prince. No, what Brandon Ballinger is looking for might frighten even the most intrepid frog kisser.
In and around 1995, 96, loads of amphibians in the Midwest started to pop up with extra legs. These kind of mutant frogs got lots of attention and completely captivated me. Just from a visual standpoint, I thought there's something really incredible about them.
So Ballinger scoops up these tiny multi-leg frogs and takes them back to his studio. There, he puts him through a chemical procedure called clear and stain.
Take a preserved specimen, put it in a series of dyes that adhere to certain tissues. Now, that staining will last. So what you then follow it up by is a clearing process, which makes the tissue essentially transparent.
These teeny mutant frogs end up looking like radiating neon 3D x-rays. Then Ballinger takes his pictures and blows them up to the size of a human child. They're totally freaky looking, and you can't take your eyes off them. But they compel your attention for another reason.
One makes the immediate jump to say, well, what other animals are deformed? Or is it safe for my kids to drink this water? Is it safe for my kids to play in this water?
That's Tiffany Holmes, professor at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago.
I think it raises a lot of health concerns, some of which are justified, some of which are unwarranted, but that's precisely the kind of concern that Ballinger wants to raise through this work.
Holmes teaches courses on eco-art, work by artists who promote an environmental message.
Most of the artists, I believe, would put their social concerns for the environment above the need to make a sort of beautiful sculpture or piece of work.
But Ballinger's work almost looks too good. Some viewers have accused him of manufacturing the monstrous frog images with Photoshop. One sci-fi blogger charges that he genetically engineered the frogs.
it would be really easy to Photoshop an image of frogs with 50 back legs. I'm not trying to make monsters. If anything, I'm trying to find out why we collectively are making monsters.
You know, I really need to figure it out for myself. I can't just listen to a politician say this is what we should be doing.
Someone who approaches eco-art in a different way is multimedia artist Andrea Poli.
The problems that the scientists are dealing with are so complex. You know, when you say global warming, well, not everywhere in the world is warming. Some places are getting colder. Some places are in drought. Some places are, flooding.
Her art is about transforming stacks of meteorological data into an audio experience. Listen to this. Now, you may think that you're hearing the inside of an alien spacecraft, but actually, you're hearing the anatomy of a hurricane. To be precise, it's Hurricane Bob, which hit the U.S. East Coast in the summer of 1991. Poli's piece, Atmospherics and Weatherworks, is a sonification of that storm.
Tell me what sonification is. What is that?
Sonification is the translation of numerical data, usually scientific data, into sound.
Data like temperature, atmospheric pressure, and total wind speed.
As scientists, we are so into the visual representation of our data. We make graphs of temperatures rising through the decades and through the century.
Dr. Cynthia Rosenzweig is head of the Climate Impacts Group at NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies.
The idea that there could be actually sounds that expressed the very same data, that was fascinating to me.
Rosenzweig helped Poli sonify some of the Institute's climate studies.
What's great about it as a scientist is that it's the actual data. It's not just the art of a storm, it's the actual data being expressed through art.
Now, sonification may blow minds at NASA, but what if you're not a climate scientist?
When I first started to hear it, parts of it reminded me of a dentist drill. And so it really made me experience psychosomatic tooth pain.
Andrea Poli's Hurricane Bob work was installed at the Tang Museum at Skidmore College, in the museum's elevator. Ginger Ertz works there.
So I didn't like it, and I took the stairs a lot. But over time, I've gotten to like it more and more.
Do you think that a work like this might help people understand the very complex nature of climate and weather?
Maybe. I know that when I do stay in here longer with students and they hear all the different pitches, it gives them a sense of the fact that there isn't just one kind of thing going on. Whether they make that leap to the rest of climate and global warming or not, we talk about it a little bit, but I don't really know how much they take away.
But wait a minute. Isn't that a problem for an eco-artist? I mean, isn't the whole point that there be a takeaway?
I just don't want people to approach the work and say, you know, this is another one of those people preaching to me about, turning my lights off or whatever. And it's really more about experiencing and appreciating the natural world. Maybe they won't get everything right away, but somehow listening to it has made them question or think about things a little bit differently.
Poli does share a sacred rule with Brandon Ballinger, the guy who takes pictures of the frogs, and that is to never manipulate the scientific data.
In this stage of controversy, the people that have political reasons to disagree with your science are going to look for the time. You know, any little inaccuracy in what you're saying is just immediately jumped on.
And these inaccuracies are fodder for talk radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh.
They cannot possibly measure the deep complexity of the climate on this planet. And yet global warming is a settled science. It is not settled, and it's not science. It is a religion. It is liberal religion, and as such, We are not permitted to question it, but people are.
Still, Brendan Ballinger likes to think that his spooky frog images just might be able to reach across party lines.
The work is seductive, and it's not designed to hit people over the head with an environmental message, but to try to get them interested. I mean, I wish Rush Limbaugh would come to an exhibition so he could see some of the pictures or let me do an environmental survey in his backyard. He might be really fascinated and potentially alarmed at what's going on back there.
For Studio 360, I'm Trey Kay.
You can check out Brendan Ballinger's pictures at studio360.org. And what do you think? Can art projects like this have a meaningful impact on how the world thinks about the environment? Or have you already been convinced by some art piece or film you think we should know about? Join the discussion at studio360.org. And I'm afraid that's it for Studio 360 today. You can re-listen to this show or any show we've ever done at our complete archive, studio360.org. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Malinowski,
Aaron Calabria,
Jess Xiao,
Michael Guerriero,
Carrie Barber.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum. Special thanks this week to Reese Ehrlich.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. And by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
I'm green, and it'll do fine. It's beautiful, and I think it's what I want to be.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, David Simon, creator of The Wire, has a new urban drama on HBO.
We're after the living city of New Orleans rather than the tourist version.
It's new territory for Simon, but he's confident that he can get New Orleans right.
It's actually the culture that saved the city.
Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.